You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
There has been a fair amount of public speculation regarding whether unconscious bias came into play in the vastly different sentences given to the two individuals who breached quarantine in Hamilton. Here we had a Pākehā man who escaped quarantine to go on an alcohol run, received 40 hours of community service, while a Māori mother got sentenced to 14 days in jail for escaping with her children to leave for a funeral, leading to public speculation regarding systematic racism. I spoke to Professor Kylie Quinn from AUT regarding whether she thinks unconscious bias had a part to play. I began by asking her for her general thoughts on the matter. And to summarise, she believes public speculation regarding unconscious bias is fairly unfounded. The Pākehā man, who out of quarantine for 30 minutes, isn't legally comparable to the woman who encouraged and facilitated a breach of quarantine not only for herself but for her children. In regards to systematic racism, this becomes relevant under the offer of reparations and the disservice paid to her by her defence team not thoroughly canvassing her options. So do you believe that the court itself has any responsibility to apply compassionate consideration when we're looking at such emotionally charged situations?
So I think that they don't have, I mean, the emotionally charged aspect is not relevant in sentencing, but there are other factors relevant. So things that are particularly relevant and are systemic issues that don't just apply to this particular situation is the fact that the woman in this case is a mother of five dependent children. Now that's hugely dependent, hugely relevant. So I think the bigger picture issue is that we shouldn't send any mothers or parents of dependent children to prison if we can absolutely help it. So the systemic issues here are whether or not imprisonment per se is a relevant or appropriate sentence for these charges. And clearly the Crown, I mean, I take what Minister Grant Robertson said on Friday in response to criticism or questions about comparisons in these two cases, the separation of powers issue that he raised, that but no doubt there was political pressure, notwithstanding what he said, no doubt there's political pressure to set a high threshold. You know, these are the first cases out the gate. I've heard words that the starting point is 3 months, which is very high. Generally speaking, we don't, you know, start with 50% of the maximum imprisonment term. That's very high. I've also heard a rumour that if there is a person who has tested positive and has escaped, then they're looking at the maximum, 5 or 6 month imprisonment. So again, that's a relevant sentencing principle in terms of wanting to deter others. So that's called general deterrence, you know, setting an example for the community to say we're taking these offences really seriously. But even in those circumstances, I do think it's relevant. We shouldn't be sending parents to prison if we can help it at all. And the race issue is relevant here, is that we're talking about the bigger picture of a government that's committed to reducing the prison population by 30% over the next 15 years. And the first and most important and easiest way to do that is that we should only reserve prison and sentences of imprisonment for violent offenders. Now, these people aren't violent offenders. Generally, we should be keeping, you know, only people go to prison where there is a risk to the safety of the public. Now, arguably, you might say that public health reaches that threshold, but I'm not sure I agree with that.
So do you believe jail time was meant to have an impact on the individual that they believed wouldn't be achieved via community service?
Well, that is what they're actually required to do by law, yes. I mean, you hit the nail on the head there. Our sentencing law requires that judges take the least restrictive, you know, they impose the least restrictive means necessary, which, as you say, means that the sentence, the intention or the objectives of the sentence cannot be met by any other means, which includes community service or home detention or community, you know, community hours or any other non-custodial options. And that's so yes, but as I've said, in this particular circumstance, in relation to the woman's sentence, effectively her lawyer took all of those other options off the table by saying she didn't have an address to serve a community-based sentence, she wasn't here for long enough to serve out community service hours, and didn't have economic means to pay reparation. That made the job particularly difficult for the judge in this case. The other point I failed to mention is that in comparative with the man's sentence, It's been lost on some of the media that he did spend 6 days in Spring Hill Prison immediately upon being apprehended. So that would have factored into the wash up of his final sentence too. So it wasn't it's not a case of 14 days imprisonment versus no imprisonment. He'd already served 6 days in apprehension and got, you know, the community service hours and the reparation order. So there is some disparity, but I think those disparities can be legitimately explained in a legal sense anyway.
Okay, and in your personal opinion, what do you believe would have been a fair sentence for these two breaches?
Good question. I'm not actually sure I would send anyone to prison for these breaches. Prison should be reserved for very serious offending, and as I've said, generally for violent offences. We have over half of our prison population who is in there for non-violent offending, and that is why we have one of the highest imprisonment rates in the OECD. It's the United States and then us. That is a shameful stain on Aotearoa New Zealand. Are we not going to address that stain by sending non-violent offenders to prison, notwithstanding that we're in a global pandemic? So I think that, one, the stigma of conviction itself is a really serious consequence. So being convicted and discharged, which means that you do get the conviction, you know, and the community gets to judge you on that conviction. It may affect your employment prospects, your ability to travel. Half the countries in the world won't let you enter if you disclose you have a criminal conviction. That's serious enough. So if it was me, I think we could have achieved the objectives of punishment for, you know, in a proportionate way for this kind of offending just by convicting those people and what's called an order to come up for sentence if you do something again within a specified period of time, like an old suspended sentence. I think that would have been send a serious enough message to the community.
And as discussed, there was a lot of pressure on these cases to set precedent just because everything surrounding COVID is fairly unprecedented territory in our courts. Do you believe that there should be sort of a period of time where COVID-related cases are treated maybe with a bit more leniency as our whole society is kind of getting used to these very new laws and kind of new ways of life?
That's an interesting question. I mean, the in legal terms, you know, the system has to deal with the parameters set by, you know, set by Parliament. Parliament has enacted these offences. Judges and lawyers and, you know, actors within the system have to, you know, have to address those factors and the parameters that Parliament has set. They have pretty, you know, not as much leeway as I think members of the public think they do. So, you know, as I think we've established already, you know, when you're the first ones out the gate, you kind of set the standard. That's how precedent works in our system. So you pitch for somewhere in the sentencing range. I do think it's interesting that they've pitched for imprisonment. They're making an example of these people. So rather than being lenient, I think leniency would not meet the objectives of what we're trying to achieve, you know, not just in a legal sense, but in a public health sense. So I think it's appropriate that they, you know, sort of use that same methodology of go hard, go early. So, you know, quite the opposite to what you might think. And I think you set quite a high precedent so that you, you know, prevent other people from undertaking the same behaviour. But even with that in mind, I think prison is really, in my view at least, a step too far. You can do that just by convicting people.
And obviously criticisms surrounding these two sentences are pretty representative of the global movement at the moment, which is paying a lot of attention to systematic racism and its effect in judicial systems. So in New Zealand, how do you think we need to start addressing this? And do you think these cases could be used in that argument or not?
So I'll answer the last question first, and that is I don't think that this is a particularly good example. This is certainly not the hill that I would die on. But notwithstanding that, and for the reasons I've said, I said I don't think that there is, you know, as much. I think there are arguments you can make about inequality here, but that inequality is on the basis of poverty and socioeconomic positioning in relation to being able to buy your way out of a prison sentence with an offer of reparation. That's not race-based. So I don't think that this is a great comparator. Having said that, there are cases every single day of the week in New Zealand that do show racial disparity and racist reasoning in justice. So we have plenty of examples to call upon. For example, in policing of drug law, and that's obviously on the table with the cannabis referendum coming up in the next month, where the for cannabis-related offending and every other offence category, rates of prosecution, charging, conviction, and imprisonment show a big gap between Māori and non-Māori in this country. So, you know, there is definitely an opportunity for us in New Zealand to, you know, use the platform of, you know, Black Lives Matter and movements like defunding the police to try and use those global movements to get some traction, local traction here in Aotearoa. My view is I don't think these particular cases are the ones to do that. There are much more egregious and explicit examples of racism in our courts that happen every day. I mean, in addition to explicit racism, though, the argument is an access to justice issue. When you're not only talking about the, resources that people have available to them to make offers of reparation and other fiscal penalties to avoid custodial ones, but access to justice in terms of the, legal advocacy and legal services available to them. So when obviously people have to have legal aid lawyers or public defence service lawyers, then that's also an issue. Not to say that they aren't good lawyers, but and that you're not well represented, but you don't get the same hours in terms of dedication service from those lawyers as you might from one who's privately retained.
So in terms of access to justice being identified as the main issue in contributing to systematic racism in this country, how do you think that needs to be, how we need to start remedying that? Or what can be, what can be
huge
made
question.
Available to all New Zealanders to ensure a fair system?
Well, there's obviously macro level issues in terms of raising of incomes, but, even in the sort of immediate to short term, we've had major cutbacks in legal aid funding in New Zealand in the last 5 to 10 years. We need education of judges and lawyers in terms of their own professional development so that they understand and respond to issues of poverty, race, culture, discrimination and inequality. We need to, really work on the mindset that we have of New Zealand that incarceration is almost our knee-jerk reaction to criminal offending. I don't think New Zealanders really understand in a global sense just how much of a carceral impulse we have, that we build prisons and we fill them. We are an incredibly punitive society compared to most other Western OECD nations. So we need to, highlight more the alternatives of what you can do differently, of the way that we can, fund police differently, the way that we can change the way that we train lawyers, the way that we train judges, different decisions we can make about funding.
Okay, so would you like to see a greater push towards punishments such as community service as opposed to kind of jumping to incarcerate as soon as possible?
Yes, absolutely. Yep, definitely. So different choices that judges can make in terms of programs available, options in relation to health and, health and addictions responses. Quite often judges, there was a case last week where an appellate court judge made a decision to incarcerate a young Māori man purely on the basis that the program that was deemed to be suitable for him was not available and he didn't have a suitable bail address. That's pure inequality and discrimination, that the government hadn't funded the appropriate addiction response program that this young man required. You can't send people to prison in those circumstances. It's just, you know, it's outrageous. There's not really any other word for it.
Sorry, would you mind elaborating a little bit more on that case?
So this was a case of a young man appearing for sentence. He had significant methamphetamine-related offending. He had significant addictions history. It was deemed appropriate by both his probation report and his cultural report that was prepared for sentence that he be sent to a Kaupapa Māori addictions response would be the appropriate sentence or outcome for him, and there was no such program available. So the judge felt that they had no option but to send him to prison. He couldn't undertake electronically monitored bail at home, home detention at home, because he didn't have an approved address. So those are all solvable problems, you know, that we shouldn't be dispensing justice on the basis of where a person lives, the money they have available to them, or this idea of what we call postcode justice, which is where you get different outcomes depending on where you live in the community. So there may have been the program that he requires in another city or another town, but not where he lived. That's an issue of geographic inequality. And these kinds of issues show up, you know, in our deprivation index, which is reported on every year, that where you live, the level of deprivation you have, and then the infrastructure and sources that are available, resources that are available to you in your community, those things should not dictate how the legal system and justice system responds to you.
And so talking about the country's readiness to incarcerate people, psychologically, what impact is jail time meant to have on individuals?
And I don't know what it's meant to have. I suppose it's meant to be a deterrent factor. It clearly isn't. And we know this because most people who are imprisoned return within 5 years, or about two-thirds of them in New Zealand return to prison within 5 years, and about a third of them within 2 years. So it's of no deterrent effect. But notwithstanding that, it has massive effects on people's, not only their individual mental health and well-being, but also that of their families. And, you know, in the case that we've seen last week in relation to parents, when parents are incarcerated, and there are, you know, 20,000 children in New Zealand that we know of who have a parent in prison, when parents are incarcerated, their children suffer enormous physical and mental health outcomes. It also becomes a really significant risk factor for their own incarceration later in life. So it has intergenerational, consequences that, again, I think we need to be can take more seriously in considering what are the impacts of imprisonment. We've seen in the last week, again, discussion around the imprisonment of the Christchurch terrorist, and really the discussion has only been on the cost of the economic cost of incarceration. Imprisonment has much more far-reaching consequences for the individual and the people that they love and people they connect to in their communities.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.